give somewhat of an introductory shiur today about melachos on Shabbos and Yisurim on Shabbos in general. And this is very important before we embark on a journey of understanding the laws of Muktzah. We have to first understand in general what the parameters of the melachos on Shabbos are and how perhaps this would fit in to that. So we mentioned last week that Shabbos in some ways seems to be very unusual. That if someone is mechallel Shabbos, we mentioned, the Gemara tells us, and it's really Rashi on Chumash quotes the Gemara, that someone who's mechallel Shabbos is dino ka'akum. They in some way lose their status as a Jew. Mechallel Shabbos befrahesia, the Gemara says, is dino ka'akum. So Rashi quotes this on Chumash, Parsha Shlach, and Rashi says that a person who's mechallel Shabbos loses their status as a Jew because the Torah puts the laws of Shabbos right next to the laws of Avodah Zarah. And the reason for that is, says Rashi, because the same way somebody who serves Avodah Zarah is considered to be someone who doesn't believe in God, they lose their status as a Jew as a result of that. So too, says Rashi, if you have somebody who's mechallel Shabbos, it's synonymous to someone who is serving Avodah Zarah. Now that sounds very extreme, and you would think that it's just a hashkafic concept, but in fact it's not a hashkafic concept at all. It is something that is very relevant lahalacha. So the Gemara tells us, number one, if you have someone who's mechallel Shabbos befrahesia, somebody who's mechallel Shabbos in public and disregards the laws of Shabbos, the Gemara says if they go ahead and do a shechita on an animal, if they slaughter an animal on behalf of another Jew, that animal is not considered to be kosher. That shechita is considered to be invalid. The Prima Gadim writes in his commentary on Shulchan Aruch that when you have somebody of this category, we assume if they go ahead and come to a shul and they want to join a minyan, so we assume that they have lost their status as a Jew and they no longer count toward one of the people for the minyan, which is very extreme, but that's the assumption, that this rule that the Gemara gives is not something that's just a hashkafic idea, that Shabbos is considered very important. It's considered so fundamental that we take it actually very seriously, and it makes a major consequence lahalacha. Finally, the Rambam writes as well, if you have someone of this nature, somebody who is mechallel Shabbos befrahesia, who goes ahead and is designated as the one to write the get on behalf of somebody else to get divorced, so the Gemara says, I'm sorry, the Rambam writes that when you have a situation like that, that get would be invalid, and the husband and wife are still considered to be married. So this is something that we take very seriously, and the reason Rashi explains is because it is synonymous to someone who serves Avodah Zarah. So there was a fascinating question that came up in the early 1900s, but it already predated that. It was a question that was raised by one of the great Gedolim in the 1800s, the Binyan Sion, Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger. So he writes in his Tshuva Sefer Binyan Sion that he had many members of his community in Germany who used to come to shul Shabbos morning, come to shul Friday night, and unfortunately because they had to somehow make a parnasa, they had to somehow support their families, they went to work on Shabbos afternoon. So he says, what is the status of a Jew like that? They are obviously not keeping Shabbos, they're working on Shabbos, they're not allowed to do so, but they're coming to shul Friday night and Shabbos morning, so you can't say that they're people who don't believe in God. So says the Binyan Sion, he has a very beautiful idea where he suggests that such a person would not be considered a mechallel Shabbos befrahesia. Because Rashi explains here, the reason why someone who's mechallel Shabbos befrahesia is written off is because it's as if you don't believe in God. Well, here you do believe in God. You're somebody who comes to shul, and you daven Kriya Shema this morning, and you daven Shema Esrei. Other circumstances in life are pushing you to have to do what you're doing. Maybe it's not the right decision. Maybe it's not the right choice. Well, all of us make the wrong choices. We all speak Lashon Hara, and we all have our challenges, and we all do the wrong things. You cannot brand such a person as somebody who doesn't believe in God. And therefore, says the Binyan Sion, perhaps when you have someone of that kind of nature, somebody who does certainly believe in God, but is pushed to be mechallel Shabbos for other reasons, perhaps we assume that that person does not lose their status as somebody who is considered to be a full-fledged Jew. And this is something that was very richly debated in his time, and Rav Soloveitchik weighed in on the issue as well. He happened to have disagreed on that point. He didn't think it was correct, but it's something that needs to be thought about. What about all the Jews in our generation? What about all the Jews in our times? What would you say about all of them? Would you say that because there is, let's say, in Israel, so would you say because there's a big presence in Israel of Orthodox Jews who are keeping Shabbos, therefore anyone who doesn't is considered to be a mechallel Shabbos befrahesia, is considered to be somebody who's not a Jew at all? So that is certainly not the case. And the reason why is because another one of the great Gedolim in the 1900s, the Melamed Lahoil, Rav David Zvi Hoffman, writes that the only time you can brand someone as a mechallel Shabbos befrahesia is when you have, let's say, in shtetl life, so you have everybody's living in one small gated community. Everybody knows the laws of Shabbos. Everybody knows what the protocols are. And now you have one person from that community who decides, in defiance, that they're going to be mechallel Shabbos and violate all the laws of Shabbos in front of anyone else, and they're not going to be careful at all who they do it in front of and where they decide to violate the Yisur. That's a person who's called a Mechal HaShabbos before Hesya. However, he writes, when you have a situation like today, where we don't live in a little shtetl, and we don't live in a place where everybody knows the rules. Most people are certainly uneducated. Most people in many communities are uneducated about all the intricacies and laws of Shabbos. And therefore, says the Malami Lahoel, you cannot say that that's in defiance that the person is driving a car on Shabbos. What do you mean? They don't even know that Shabbos is something that requires me not to drive a car. They don't know that Shabbos is something that requires me to do many different things. And therefore, we assume that nowadays, most of the situations that we have are not really considered to be a Mechal HaShabbos before Hesya, because the whole circumstances have changed from the way that they used to be. Yeah.
Just as a point of information, it's very common practice in the Syrian community. Mm-hmm. They go to shul in the morning, then they go off to work and come back and talk to the Gemara.
Still today?
Yeah. Just
I'm saying still today that's what's done?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Down in the Deal community.
Uh-huh. So... So I don't, I'm not one to cast aspersions on other communities, but obviously that is not the proper choice, that is not the right thing to do, but that gets into the question of the Binyan Sion, would you allow such a person to be considered to be a regular full-fledged doer? Do you say perhaps we have to put their Judaism into question? I think there's enough to rely on. The Binyan Sion was a great enough gadol to say that we shouldn't write off such communities, and we should say that his psak was good enough for us to rely on, even though Rav Soloveitchik may have disagreed, but I don't know that they... People who are not followers of Rav Soloveitchik have to follow his opinion, certainly for something of this nature. Yeah. So that's what the Chazon Ish writes, that nowadays many of the members of the community in Israel, or in many different communities, weren't raised as being educated at all. They don't know any different. And you'll say, what do you mean? But they see others that were keeping Shabbos. So don't they know about Shabbos? They know many of the stores are closed. They know you go to Yerushalayim and you see that business is not running as usual. So my father always likes to say, yeah, they might know that, but they don't know that that's not just the ultra-Orthodox chumrah. I mean, they don't know that that's what the Torah expects them to do also. They think that's given for those people. They don't know that that's something that's supposed to be expected of everybody. So again, we're trying to educate, and you can do whatever you can, but that doesn't mean that just because they're not following, it brands all of them as Mechalei Shabbos Befer Hesya, and that's the general assumption today. The Chazon Ish, who was the great Gadol in Bnei Brak, decided also as well that the Jews who live in Israel in his generation were not considered to be Mechal HaShabbos before Hesya because they were simply uneducated. There was no way to expect them to have to know all of the laws of Shabbos that they should keep to. So let's begin our discussion about the parameters of the Melacha of Shabbos. And by way of introduction, the Gemara says in Maseches Chagiga Daf Yud that when it comes to Hilchos Shabbos or Chagiga or Me'ila are the laws that govern when one takes something that's the property that belongs to the Beis HaMikdash, and that's something that is considered to be an egregious error. You're not allowed to steal from the Beis HaMikdash, you're not allowed to damage the property of the Beis HaMikdash. So all of those laws, the Gemara tells us, Hareihem, they can be categorized as Kehararim HaTluyim Bisara. Those are like big mountains that are hanging on by a thread. And what does it mean? Shehein Mikra Muat V'Halachos Merubas, because they are such intricate sets of laws. And yet, if you look in the psukim themselves, you find very little detail that tells you how exactly you're supposed to follow those laws. So you look through all the pages in Chumash and you wonder, what are the laws of Shabbos? You will not find it. You will not find all the malachas that you're not allowed to do. You will not find the description of all the intricacies that we all might be aware of. The Torah itself does not really tell us. And that's what the Gemara describes this as, a har hatali bisar. It's like a big mountain that's hanging on a tiny thread because the psukim and chumash really give you very little information. So where do we learn all of the laws of Shabbos from? What are they derived from? So the Gemara tells us in Maseches Shabbos Daf Memtes, this is number Beis on the sheet, that this was a discussion in the times of the Gemara, and they wondered, how do we know where all the laws of Shabbos stem from? So the Gemara says that it comes from the fact that we had avodas hamishkan. It comes from all the activities that were done, that were performed in the Mishkan, is what we learn our laws of Shabbos from. What is the connection between the Mishkan and Shabbos? So the Psukim, if you'll notice, the Psukim in a number of places put together the law of building and constructing a Mishkan together with the laws of Shabbos. Shabbosai tishmori mikdashi tiro ani Hashem. It says that you have to build a Beis HaMikdash, and you have to keep and abide by the laws of Shabbos. And the Gemara assumes that from there must be some sort of intrinsic connection which teaches us that all the laws of Shabbos are governed by whatever activities were done in the Beis HaMikdash, in the Mishkan. Whatever was done there is whatever is prohibited for us to do in our laws of Shabbos practically. So you look through the laws of Shabbos in the Chumash and you don't find an exact detail of what exactly should or should not be done, but all of it is learned out from that original place, from that source, which is the building of the Mishkan. And that is something that we now have to figure out, well, how do we apply all of that to our modern-day circumstances? So take, for example, just by way of understanding, so we have 39 melachos of Shabbos, 39 prohibited activities that the Torah actually, we consider to be prohibited by Torah law. Outside of that, we have many rabbinic laws that were added on later on, and there's going to be a major distinction between that which is a Torah prohibition and that which is only added on by the Chacham and by the rabbinic authorities later on, as we'll see in a few minutes. So in order to understand that difference, let's just explain the following. The Gemara tells us in Maseches Yuma, we have an introduction to a very strange phenomenon, which was the Urim V'Tumim. So in the days of the Beis HaMikdash, they had many different parts, many different facets of the Beis HaMikdash. And one of the more interesting parts of it was when you had the Urim V'Tumim, which were worn by the Kohen Gadol on the breastplate. And that was something that provided the answers to the critical questions of the Jewish people of the time. So the Gemara has a discussion. So when I go and I present a question to the Urim V'Tumim, for example, Jewish people want to know, should we go out to fight a war or not? Well, obviously we need to strategize and we need to figure out how we're going to do it, but then we ultimately pose the question to the Urim V'Tumim, and we ask the Urim V'Tumim, is this something that should be done or not? Well, if the Urim V'Tumim gives us the answer, yes, Cain, then we know we go out to war. If the Urim V'Tumim gives us the answer, lo, then it means don't go out to war. I assume the answers were a little more complex than that, but that's the basic gist. So how exactly did the answer come about? So we present our question. Now, what kind of response are we supposed to be getting from the Urim V'Tumim? So you ask people, some people think it means there was a voice that came out of the Urim V'Tumim. You'll see in a few minutes why this is extremely relevant to Hilchos Shabbos, but just explaining it first. We're going to get there. What you see is Kala Torah Kula is all Miksha Achas. The whole Torah is interrelated and interconnected. And you have to draw certain assumptions and certain understandings from different parts of Torah that otherwise would be unexpected to learn from. Sometimes that can shine a major light on Hilchos Shabbos and other areas of Torah as well. So here, you have the Urim V'Tumim, and some people mistakenly think that when a question was presented, the Urim V'Tumim responded in a voice. That is not true. What happened was, the Urim V'Tumim had a bunch of letters on it, and somehow the letters formulated the answer. So Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish argue in the Gemara how exactly that answer came about. Is it that the letters protruded, meaning you had a bunch of letters, and now the letters that were relevant to your answer protruded, and now you had to unscramble the letters and figure out what it meant? Or did the letters actually protrude and then join together to spell a word? So Reish Lakish is of the opinion that you don't have to make a jumble out of the letters and figure out what it meant, because then you can misinterpret it. So Reish Lakish was of the opinion that the letters didn't just protrude, but they actually joined together. Osios mitzdarfos. It was like a whole message that was written out on the Urim V'Tumim, exactly the way the answer was supposed to be formulated. That was the answer that was given. That's the opinion of Reish Lakish. And if that's the case, the Achronim asked, well, what happens if we have a dilemma on Shabbos and we want to consult the Urim V'Tumim on Shabbos? Do I have a right to stand before the Urim V'Tumim and present my question to the Urim V'Tumim when I know that something is going to be written as a result of my presenting the question? So that was the question that was raised by the Achronim. Did the Jews have the right to present questions to the Urim V'Tumim when they knew that the Urim V'Tumim was going to formulate an answer in a written version? That's a malach of ksiva on Shabbos. Something is actually being written. Am I allowed to do that, or perhaps that is forbidden on Shabbos? So that was a big question, and there are two basic approaches given to answer this question, both of which are extremely important. Number one, approach number one of why it's permissible to present a question to the Urim V'Tumim on Shabbos was as follows, because the Rush writes in Maseches Psachim, we know that Moshe Rabbeinu passed away on a Shabbos afternoon. And that is why, if you'll notice, on Shabbos afternoon, we say Tzidkas Chatzedek. Shabbos afternoon, we basically make a Kel Malei, not like me who makes for live people. Moshe Rabbeinu actually passed away, and we make a Kel Malei for Moshe Rabbeinu. We say Tzidkas Chatzedek. Tziduk Adin is really our appreciation for Moshe Rabbeinu's death. And that's why we say it on Shabbos afternoon, because that's the time when Moshe Rabbeinu passed away. So the Medrash tells us Moshe Rabbeinu dies on a Shabbos, and yet the Medrash says, what did he do on the last day of his life? What was he busy with? So the Medrash tells us the last day of his life, Moshe Rabbeinu was concerned with the following. I was the great Moshe Rabbeinu. I was the one who accepted the Torah from God's mouth himself. I was the one who gave it over to the Jewish people. What's going to happen after I die? And now there's not going to be that same clarity that there was in the days when I was alive. What's going to happen when there's some kind of discrepancy and people are going to be fighting about, well, did the Torah really say this? Did the Torah say that? Did Moshe Rabbeinu mean this? Did he mean that? And Moshe Rabbeinu decided, in order to make sure that none of that is going to happen, he wrote 13 Sifrei Torah on the last day of his life. He gave one out to each of the Shvatim. He kept one of the Mishkan this way. Nobody can fight or argue later on what exactly the text of the Torah was. Moshe Rabbeinu put it down in print for us, that it should be there for everyone to know exactly what the Torah stated. Well, ask the Rishonim, if Moshe Rabbeinu died on a Shabbos afternoon, how exactly did he write 13 Sifrei Torah on Shabbos? Isn't that a Malach of Kosev? And furthermore, even if it wasn't Shabbos, how could a human being ever write 13 Sifrei Torah in one day? You ever try to write an article for a newspaper? It takes a long time, and that's just one page. So imagine if you're trying to write 13 Sifrei Torah, how are you going to write 13 Sifrei Torah in one day? It's impossible. So the Rishonim give the answer, the Shalah HaKadosh is quoted as saying the same, that Moshe Rabbeinu did this al yedei hashba'as hakulmus, which means he used some sort of necromancy, he used some sort of magical, mystical power, and that's the way that the quill just wrote itself. And 13 Sifrei Torah were automatically written this way, and Moshe Rabbeinu did it through a miracle, and that's the way it was done. And therefore, since it happened miraculously, that's not considered to be a malacha, because he actually was not really involved. All he did was he said the Shem Hashem, or whatever he did, and the Sifrei Torah just wrote themselves. So therefore, that is not considered a melacha, and that's how Moshe Rabbeinu was allowed to do it. And that is the answer number one that is given to why one would be allowed to give a question presented to the Urim V'Tumim on Shabbos, because the answer that was given was a miraculous answer. You're right. A whole message comes out and it's written exactly in form the way I'm supposed to understand it, but I didn't do anything. All I did was present the question. Now, miraculously, something came about as a result of what I did. Therefore, we assume, since it happened miraculously, that is not considered to be a malacha on Shabbos. And similarly, the Gemara says in Maseches Sanhedrin, let's say you have some sort of animal that's running around and bothering everybody on Shabbos, and we don't know what to do. Well, you're not really allowed to trap an animal on Shabbos. That would be a malacha of tzeda. So what am I supposed to do when I have this animal and we're concerned that it's going to bother people? So the Gemara says, well, simple. Lochshin lechishos. We all know how to use that magical word that gets the animal to be trapped and tied up together, whatever it might be. So the Gemara says, no problem at all. You're allowed to do that. How am I allowed to do that? Don't I know that the animal is going to be trapped as a result of the words that I'm using? Well, the answer is that that is not something that's natural. That's something that's totally miraculous. So you're using some kind of strange word and you're saying a whole pismon, and because of that the animal gets trapped somewhere. We don't assume that that's considered to be a malach on Shabbos, even though it's bringing about the same result. The same result which would have been forbidden for me to do, but since it's happening in a miraculous way, we don't consider that to be a malacha at all. It's similar to what the Chacham Tzvi discusses. Chacham Tzvi has a discussion which I guess was prevalent in his time. So we all know there's a famous legend about the Maharal Prague who created a golem, and there's questions about whether it really happened or it didn't happen. But over the generations, whether the Maharal Prague actually did it or not is a question, but it certainly was done over the generations. There's something the Gemara talks about, that you can create people through Sefer Yetzirah. There's some sort of magical way you can create a person. So the Chacham Tzvi has a discussion, which I thought was a theoretical discussion, but the Mishneh Berurah actually quotes it, la'alacha. What if you have somebody who's created through Sefer Yetzirah, which means you have this miraculous human being, and now you're short one for a minion, so you call this person in and you want them to be a part of the minion. So the Chacham Tzvi says, can we really count such a person as part of the minion? They're not really a person, but after all, they are a person. It looks like a person, smells like a person. Maybe we should say it is a person. So, again, the Chacham Tzvi comes to the conclusion that since we assume that that person was created miraculously, and all of us are created miraculously, but that's obviously a greater miracle, and that's not a real person, and therefore he assumes you cannot count such a person for a minion. That's not a real human being like the rest of human beings are considered to be. And the Acharonim discuss, let's say I create this imaginative human being and I have this human being helping me out all the time and driving my car and being my chauffeur and doing whatever it needs to be done for me. Well, after 10 years of being living together with this person, I had enough. So am I allowed to kill this person? Let's say I think, you know, it was a nice stint for the long while that I had them, but now I'm getting annoyed. I don't like the personality. I didn't like the way the nose came out. I don't like the way everything was done. Do I have a right to now kill that person, or do you assume, no, that they take on a status as a real human being once they're created? So all of this is a discussion, and the general assumption is whenever you have something that is created miraculously, that is not considered to be a real creation. And therefore we assume that it's not considered to be a malacha on Shabbos if something happens miraculously. That's how Moshe Rabbeinu was able to write the Sifrei Torah, because he did it in a miraculous way. That's where the Gemara says you're able to trap the animals on Shabbos through saying some sort of words that you put together. That's also not considered to be a malacha, because anything that happens in a miraculous way is not a problem at all. That's answer number one. And that's answer number one, how we were able to present the question to the Urim V'Tumim on Shabbos, because after all, the answer, the response that we were given was a miraculous answer. Approach number two, which is extremely relevant to us and to our technology today, is the following. The only time you can violate a malacha, a biblical prohibition on Shabbos, let's say ksiva, here we're talking about writing on Shabbos. You get the answer through the Urim V'Tumim because a whole message comes out through writing. So the only way you can violate a malacha on Shabbos is if you actively did something. But if you weren't actively engaged in anything that came about, and it just happened by itself, we assume that is not considered to be a malacha on Shabbos. You cannot violate a malacha on Shabbos without actively being involved. And you'll see in a minute exactly what we mean. So over here, what happens? I stand before the Urim V'Tumim and I think about my question that's bothering me. Immediately the Urim V'Tumim gives an answer. Did I do anything? I did nothing. I wasn't actively involved in that malacha taking place. I just stood there and I was thinking. And as a result of my thought process of the question that was bothering me, all of a sudden an answer came about. A malacha happened by itself. When I have nothing to do with that malacha, when I did no active part in that malacha taking place, we assume that is not considered to be a malacha on Shabbos. And Rav Soloveitchik proved this from the following Mishnah. The Mishnah says in Maseches Shabbos, we have one of the 39 malachas on Shabbos is, you're not allowed to trap an animal. Seder. So what happens, say for example, you have an animal runs into a house on Shabbos. The Gemara gives the example of a tzvi, of a deer that runs into a house. So that's a frightening experience. But imagine you have some kind of other animal runs into a house on Shabbos. Now the door happens to be open. So is the animal trapped right now? No, because the animal can run right out. Says the Gemara, it would be a malacha if I close the door. Why? Now I'm trapping the animal. While the door was open, the animal was able to get out. Now that I close the door, I'm trapping the animal. What about for me to stand in the doorway? Instead of closing the door, I decide I'm going to stand there and block the doorway so the animal can't get out. What would you say? That's also considered trapping. Why? Because the animal originally was able to get out. Now that I'm standing in the way, the animal is not able to get out. So what happens in the following scenario, says the Gemara? Somebody stands in front of the doorway. They violate the malacha of trapping on Shabbos because now they prevent the animal from going out. I go and I stand in front of that person. So now what am I doing when I stand in front of that person? Nothing. The animal is trapped without me. Now change the case. That first person now moves away. And now I'm left standing in front of the door and I'm the only one blocking the door from that animal getting out. What would you say?
You just went to stand there.
Huh. So those who think that I'm violating malacha, raise your hand. Those who think I'm not violating malacha, raise your hands. That's not all the people in the room. So the Gemara says you are not in violation of a malacha if you do it that way. Why not? But the same thing happened, right? I brought about the same result. The animal is now trapped. The answer is the animal is trapped, but I did not that it wasn't my intention. I, at the time that I stood in front of the door, I violated nothing. It turns out later on that I'm violating a malacha because I happen to be the one standing there, but I cannot be in violation of malacha without doing something actively to perform that malacha. So here the activity that I did, the action that I did, was at a time when it was irrelevant. Now that it becomes relevant, I'm just a bystander. I did nothing actively to violate it. And Seder of Soloveitchik, you see from there that one cannot violate a malacha on Shabbos without actively being engaged in that malacha taking place. So yes, sometimes the same result, the same prohibited result might come about, but you cannot pin that on me and say that I am in violation of the malacha. And that's the answer to the Urim V'Tumim. I did nothing actively to create that answer. All I did was I thought. And because I had no active engagement in the Urim V'Tumim giving that response, therefore we assume that that is not considered to be a malacha on Shabbos, which has extreme consequences for our modern technology. Say, for example, what would you say, we mentioned last week, and I got a number of questions about it, for those who have the Nest air conditioning and heating system in their house on a Shabbos. So what do you do about that? What happens with the system is, in very preliminary terms, there are a number of settings, but for those who got the original Nest system before it was advanced, what it does is, in my understanding, from what people have explained to me, that it's able to regulate temperature based on people who are walking into the room or based on personalities that they might have come to learn. So let's say I happen to have my house, let's say, on 75 degrees because that's what everyone is comfortable with. Let's say I happen to go to sleep and I like to be cold, but the rest of my house likes to be warm. So I have a Nest system in my room, let's say, which knows that when I walk in, it knows me, and it knows that when I come into the room, it should be 65 degrees instead of 75 degrees, something of that nature. Well, How do I deal with that on Shabbos? This is something, if you don't know, many people in our community have this system on Shabbos, and that's a major problem. It's a problem not only for those living in the house, it's a problem for those who are visiting their homes as well. Now, it happens to be now they created a Nest system which has a bypass that you can just keep it the way it is and have it set like a normal air conditioning system. But if you have the non-bypass system, that creates a major problem for Shabbos. So you'll say, I'm not pushing any buttons, I'm not doing anything. Yeah, but you're walking into the room. That is the way to activate the malacha. You're doing something by walking in. What about walking by a motion sensor or light on Shabbos? I'm not flicking the light on Shabbos. Yeah, but by you walking by, that's what's creating the malacha to come about. What about those of us who might have cameras all around their house on Shabbos? Anyone ever think about that? How do we walk in and out of our houses on Shabbos when you have a camera that you know is running? So if I'm the one who's visiting someone else's house and I happen not to know that there's a camera, so that we say is perhaps a davar shena mischaven, I had no idea that I was doing that. It's something that I have no interest in at all. It makes no difference to my life at all whether or not I'm being videoed. Maybe that's permissible on Shabbos, but for the one who actually owns the house and does care very much that the camera is working because they want to be able to see something that might be unusual activity, so for them, a camera around the house is a very serious question, and you have to deal with that and figure out how are you going to deal with the camera that's in front of your house on Shabbos when you're walking in and out of the door, and every time you walk in and out, it is videoing you. You're creating a malacha. You're making a malacha take place by the fact that you're walking. So there, you're actively engaged in the malacha. What about change the case a little bit? Anyone here ever heard of BCI technology? No? I love talking about it because it's so amazing. It's so amazing to appreciate. I've read so much about it because it's an amazing advancement of technology. So BCI technology is something that we have to deal with lahalacha now. It's called brain-computer interface. And BCI technology is essentially a direct communication pathway that was created between one's brain and an external device. So say, for example, it was created for those who have prosthetics. So you no longer need to program the prosthetic to do certain things. All you need to do is put a chip in the person's brain, and that is able to interpret the thought process of the brain and create a reaction in an external device as a result of your thought. So you have to do nothing other than think. So the same way you used to think when you had two of your own legs, you used to think that now I should walk here or now I should go there. So now it's able to translate that thought process into the prosthetic, and the prosthetic could work solely off of your brain. It's being used already. It's an amazing technology. And it's something that is creating major problems. Forgetting about prosthetics, it's creating major problems because what they have created is children's games that work this way as well. So you can have a children's video game that they just give the kid an electrode cap where they put all kinds of sensors on the brain. And now the kid, all they have to do is think. Now I want to shoot. Now I want to drive. Now I want to go here. Now I want to go there. And they don't even have to use their hands at all. And this question has been presented. Is this something that's permissible on Shabbos? So theoretically, the scientists are saying, from what I've read, that in another 20 years from now, you can be sitting in your kitchen, and just by thinking, everyone can have one of these chips put into their brain, and by thinking alone, you can have, your oven is going to go on, your car can start, you can open your garage, you can do all kinds of malachas without doing a single activity. All you're doing is just thinking. Can I really call that a malacha? Is that the same as a person who walks in front of the video camera? Is that the same as somebody who walks into a home and the Nest system is activated? Well, over there at least I'm actively engaged. I'm doing something. Over here I'm doing nothing. I'm just sitting in my house and thinking. What are you going to tell me? Thinking alone is called a malacha? No one's allowed to think on Shabbos? So that's a problem. These are real problems that we're facing today. And much of the discussion stems around this discussion by the Urim V'Tumim. Should we assume that because I had to think to present my question to the Urim V'Tumim, it was all by thought process, by thinking alone, I presented my question, and my question was answered, and a malacha took place as a result of my thought, is that really considered to be my malacha? Did I really do anything wrong because I created that malacha? I made it happen, but I didn't really do anything. I didn't do any activity in order for that to happen. All I did was I thought. And now malacha happened as a result of my thought, which, as we mentioned, is extremely relevant today with the advancement of technology, and we're seeing that we can actually have such a thing where a malacha can take place. Real malachas can take place by simply thinking about something that you want to take place. Any questions? Yeah.
So in the case of the prosthesis, yeah. Is that becoming a part of a person's body, therefore it has a different status?
So again, by prosthetics, there are many who would be makel, certainly, because that's something that, again, it's a very complicated issue, but for prosthetics, there's a lot of room to discuss it. For video games, you know. No, for real, I think for prosthetics, we are makel. Number one, because you're not doing anything. There is no malacha. Yes, a malacha is taking place as a result of your thought, but you're really not doing anything. Yeah. So I think people misunderstand what grama really means. Grama does not mean, and this was the mistake people made when the grama switch came out. Remember a couple of years ago there was a big discussion about the grama switch, that somebody wanted to create a light switch where you can turn on and off the lights because there's going to be an indirect reaction that's going to take place. That's not what grama means. Grama's definition, Rav Soloveitchik explained, and many other achronim, Rav Shlomo Zalman said the same way, and Rav Neuvert writes in the Shmir Shabbos Kilchasa that people misunderstand grama. They think it means if it happens indirectly and not immediately, that's called a grama. That's not really what it means. The Gemara gives the case of grama with regard to ritzicha, with regard to death. So the Gemara in Sanhedrin talks about, let's say I tie someone up in the burning hot sun in the middle of the Sahara Desert, and I don't leave them any water. So am I considered a rotzeach or not? Yes. Why? Because I left them in the middle of the desert, I tied them up, I didn't give them any water, and I didn't give them the possibility of possibly surviving. Therefore, I'm considered to be a murderer, even though it's going to happen only after 10 hours. Why is that considered murder? Because there was nothing else that was necessary in order for that to take place. I left them in the burning hot sun, with no water, tied up. It's obvious that even though nothing else needs to happen other than time, it's obvious that I'm considered to be the murderer. However, the Gemara says, what if I leave them tied up and I need koach acher me'urvba, I need something else to happen in order for this murder to take place, so I will be somehow responsible, but can you actually call me a murderer? No. Says the Gemara, I cannot be called a rotzeach if I tie the person up and all that's necessary is I need the lightning to strike in order for them to get killed. Meaning I need something else to happen. So yes, can I be considered somehow a perpetrator of the crime? Yes. But can I be branded as a rotzeach, or do you call that gram ritzicha? There, says the Gemara, that's called gram ritzicha because you need a koach acher me'urba. You need something else to kick in order for the murder to take place, and that's where we consider it to be a grama. And therefore, people misunderstand grama on Shabbos to mean the same. They think as long as there's a delayed reaction, that means that it's a grama. That's not correct. That's not the definition of grama. What grama means is, if you need something else to kick in order for this to happen, that's what we would consider to be a grama. But outside of that, just because I flick a switch and it only goes on after 5 or 10 minutes, that doesn't mean that that's a grama. That's called your malacha. That's the same as tying somebody up in the desert, leaving them out in the burning hot sun, and you know in another 2-3 hours from now they're going to die from dehydration. So that's why grama, I think, is something that is not really relevant to this discussion, but grama is something that's important to know in general with regard to many areas of Shabbos and how we figure out where grama is permissible and where grama perhaps might not be permissible. So as we mentioned, when it comes to an actual malacha, from the 39 biblical malachas on Shabbos, we assume the only way you can violate them is if you're actively involved in the malacha itself. Now we turn our attention to a different category, which is forgetting about those 39 malachos. What about Isurim Derabbanan? There are many rabbinic prohibitions which were instituted on Shabbos. And the question is, when we come across those, are those able to be violated even passively? Or can you only violate those actively? And as we'll see in a few minutes, that is also very relevant to our generation with certain technologies that we have to be aware of. Yeah.
So I was thinking in terms of the Shabbos elevator.
Meaning, why can't everybody use the Shabbos elevator?
Right.
Why do we only leave it for those who are in need of it? So that's a question. That's a big question. What kind of Shabbos elevator you have? So some of the Shabbos elevators, people think a Shabbos elevator just means that it stops at every floor. That doesn't make it permissible. Shabbos elevators also have to have, I think Rabbi Shlomo Zalman writes about this, they also have to have a mechanism where sometimes I think based on the weight, I know nothing about how this works, but somehow based on the weight, it's going to work harder or less hard. Based on hydraulics, I don't know exactly the mechanism and how it works, which means that you are, by going into the elevator, you are activating a system to take place. So for a chola, for somebody who needs it, we might allow it. But just because I decided to stay in a hotel on Shabbos and I don't want to walk up 10 flights of stairs, doesn't make me have the right to go in a Shabbos elevator. First of all, who told you to stay in that hotel? And who told you to stay on the 10th floor? We don't just give a heter just because somebody's in a hotel for Shabbos. Who told you to stay there? So you set yourself up in a situation where you're going to need to be Mechal Shabbos. That's not something that gives you permission to be Mechal Shabbos. You should have thought of that before Shabbos started. So that's number one. So you'll say, what do you mean, but I have to go to shul? Maybe you should walk down the stairs, or maybe don't go to shul. So that's something that needs to be thought about when you have a Shabbos elevator. Number one, is it the real Shabbos elevator that has the system and the mechanism set up in place? In most apartment buildings where you have a Shabbos elevator, the Shabbos elevator is not really with that mechanism that it doesn't work based on weight. Most of the times, the Shabbos elevator that is set up in many apartment buildings is that it just stops on every floor on Shabbos. That's very, very, very highly questionable. And it should only be used by those who absolutely need it.
What about in hospitals?
What? What? Question?
Yeah, the hospitals.
Yeah.
A lot of times you don't have access to the stairs, and they have a Shabbos elevator. What's the deal there?
So you have to know each case and exactly what it is. You have to know each case and know what the mechanism is. Life is becoming more and more complicated. I would imagine another 5 years from now, we're not going to be able to walk into any building that doesn't have electronic automatic lights. What? Things should be changed? With what? Yeah.
So I think that a bain should think about a way of allowing people to live in the modern world.
I take that as a tremendous offense, to be honest with you, because if you read the literature of today, all of this is being tackled. All of it is being dealt with. It's not that we change the halacha. We need to perhaps apply different principles in order to deal with these issues. The issues are certainly being dealt with. As I said, I knew what BCI technology was. No one else here did. Right? We are dealing with the technology of our times. We are dealing with the issues, and these are something that are cutting-edge issues. I'm just saying that when you forecast in the next 5-10 years, life is going to become extremely difficult. Will we ever go into a bathroom that is not going to be automatic? Who's going to have such a thing anymore? And who's going to have light bulbs that don't automatically go on and off in order to save energy and to save money? So I'm saying these things are being dealt with, but they need to be dealt with very carefully. And we need to be aware, as even if we're not the decision makers, we need to at least be aware of the issues. When we're building a house, when we are putting in various technologies that are now on the market, we have to know in terms of cooking on Shabbos and in terms of lights on Shabbos and electricity and all the security systems and the alarm. And you have to really think about these things. And what happens every time I open my door, even if I deactivate my alarm, right? How many people think about this? Every time you open the door, even if the alarm is deactivated, many times if you don't deactivate it properly, there can still be the red and green light goes on and off every time you open the door and close it on Shabbos. Well, we have to think about these things. We have to think about it and wonder, are we really keeping Shabbos in the proper way? And as life becomes more and more technologically advanced, we have to figure out whether or not we're keeping Shabbos the way we should or perhaps not. What? So we have to evaluate each case. I don't think, again, I could be wrong, but I don't think that we would say that it's a pikuach nefesh, that's a reasonable pikuach nefesh.
He met a black person in his house.
I appreciate that. And no, and it's certainly a terrible and probably a very frightening story, and he's lucky to be alive and healthy. However, I'm not saying nobody should have. I'm just saying we need to be... It depends. It really depends. You know, let's say I spoke to my father. It's a very controversial issue about having security teams in a shul. And what are they allowed to do and what are they not? So many people discuss it here in our shul. Should we really have the security team? Should we not? Is this something that is really warranted? Are we allowed to have people turning flashlights on a Shabbos and holding certain devices and whatever it might be? Very interesting question. And I think it depends on your perspective. At least for me, I feel... with the sheer number of people that we have coming into our shul on a Shabbos, and the amount of threat, you speak to the police, both locally and the city police, you speak to them about the possibility of a threat to a synagogue that's of this magnitude, I think it's a real threat. It's something real. And therefore, I think we have every right to have a security team, at least in our shul. If I have a little shtiebel in my basement, I don't think it's so important that you need to have somebody who's going to be mechallel Shabbos on behalf of the 20 people davening in my basement shtiebel. It's not the same question. And I think that's a question we need to think about when we have security cameras on Shabbos also. Do I think that by the Kotel it's important that they have security cameras? Absolutely. Otherwise, we're all in tremendous danger. Does it mean none of us are allowed to go? Of course we're allowed to go on Shabbos. However, do I think that it's the same level of danger by every individual's home? Probably not. I would imagine we would say not. What is the level of danger that we would say is reasonable to say I have a right to install this camera and not worry about it on a Shabbos? I think that's something that we absolutely need to think about. I don't think we could just write it off and say, well, it's pikuach nefesh and therefore it's mutter. Not everything is considered to be pikuach nefesh. Yes, it's true. Once in a while, something does go wrong and something does happen. But that doesn't mean that everything now becomes pikuach nefesh and now everything's permissible on Shabbos. So I'm not saying you can't, but I'm saying you have to really think about it carefully and break down the question to its entirety and understand exactly what it is that we're dealing with. So let's get back to where we were discussing about what about rabbinic prohibitions on Shabbos. So you have melachos on Shabbos, as we said, cannot be violated without doing some kind of activity which is going to trigger that melacha to happen. What about a isur derabbanan? For example, the Chachamim set up many different isurim, many different prohibitions and violations on Shabbos, in which they said you're not allowed to do X because they're concerned it's going to lead you to do Y, which is far, far worse than X. So take, for example, there's an isur on Shabbos to have shehiya. What does shehiya mean? Shehiya means you're not allowed to leave something on the fire from Erev Shabbos going into Shabbos. Now, what am I not allowed to leave on the fire? If something is already cooked, you're allowed to leave it on the fire. If something is not cooked, I'm not allowed to leave it on the fire. Why am I not allowed to leave it on the fire? When did I do a malacha? When can you pinpoint me and say, oh, you violated the malacha? When? I put it on Erev Shabbos. Now Shabbos comes in, everything's happening on its own. So what have I done wrong? I don't stir it, I don't touch it, I don't do anything. When did I violate the Isser?
When you first put it on.
But it was Erev Shabbos. So I put it on the fire, it wasn't cooked, but didn't we just say that you cannot violate a malacha on Shabbos without some sort of activity being done? So I didn't do anything. When I put this on the fire, it was Erev Shabbos. Now Shabbos comes in and it's cooking and cooking, but I didn't do anything. So why should that be prohibited? There's a halacha of bishul, but you have to actively cook something. Here I didn't do anything. So why should there be a problem? So the answer to that is, here we're dealing with a rabbinic prohibition. It's a rabbinic prohibition called shehiya. That is shin, hey, yud, yud, hey. That is called shehiya. Now the prohibition of shehiya on Shabbos is that you're not allowed to leave something on the fire before Shabbos begins and let it cook over Shabbos, even though I did nothing actively on Shabbos itself. Why is that prohibited? I didn't do anything actively, and we just said you cannot violate the laws of Shabbos. Well, the reason why the Chachamim, the reason why the rabbis instituted such a thing is because they were concerned it's going to lead you to cook on Shabbos. So because they're concerned it's going to lead you to do some sort of activity of malacha, therefore they said this can be violated even passively, even without doing anything. I did all the activity before Shabbos began. I did nothing once Shabbos started, but I'm already in violation of the Issur D'Rabbanan. Why? Because they assume even passively you can violate this prohibition because they're concerned maybe it's going to lead to something active. Take for another example. Another example the Gemara gives is the following. We have a rabbinic prohibition on Shabbos to climb up on a tree. Why? What's wrong with climbing on a tree? Maybe I enjoy it. Answer is, says the Gemara, we're concerned, maybe you're going to break a branch. Well, if I break a branch on Shabbos, what's that? That's a real malacha. That's a real prohibition. That is kotzer. That is cutting off something that's attached to the ground. So now I'm walking up the tree, and I'm being careful, and it's a very sturdy tree. And I know that I'm not allowed to break off a branch. What am I violating? All I'm violating is a rabbinic prohibition. Because they were concerned that it's going to lead you to do something worse, therefore they said you cannot even get near it. Therefore they said you cannot even go up on the tree. So the Gemara gives the following example. Erev in Daf Kuf, the Gemara says, what happens when you have a person who climbed up on the tree on Erev Shabbos and is having a great time in the treehouse? Now they realize Shabbos already came in. What do I do now? Well, am I in violation if I just sit in my place the entire Shabbos? Am I in violation of anything if I just stay where I am? Yes or no? All those in favor of me being in violation of Malach on Shabbos, raise your hands. Well, the Gemara says you are in violation of a prohibition on Shabbos. Why? But I didn't do anything. I didn't go up on the tree on Shabbos. I happened to end up there. Well, the answer is, that since we're dealing here with an Isser Derabbanan, since we're dealing here with only a rabbinic prohibition, which is you're not allowed to go up on a tree on Shabbos, you can violate that even passively. Why? Because by you sitting on the tree, we still have the concern that maybe you're going to break off a branch. Even if I didn't climb up on Shabbos, since you ended up there before Shabbos started and now Shabbos came in, we still have the same concern and you're going to be in the same violation of that prohibition, even though you did nothing actively on Shabbos, you just happened to be sitting there. That's still a violation of this rabbinic prohibition because we're concerned it's going to lead you to do something far worse. So you'll say, why is any of this relevant? So it's relevant for the following. If you look in the Torah, if you look at the Lamentes Avos Melachos, nowhere does it say that you're not allowed to do business on Shabbos. Nowhere. So in the original days of Moshe Rabbeinu, I would imagine that on Shabbos was the day that everybody had a day off. So people were probably going to the markets and buying and selling and doing whatever had to be done. What could be wrong with that? There was no prohibition of muktzah yet. There was no prohibition of doing any buying and selling. What could be wrong? So I went to the supermarket. I stocked up on everything. I went to the local malls. I bought all the clothing that I wasn't able to buy during the week. It was wonderful. And then, somehow this stopped. Why did it stop? So the Gemara says that the Chachamim came along and said, you're not allowed to do that anymore. Why? Because we're concerned. Gzeira Shema Yichtov. As we know, when I have a business, I want to keep an account, a record of what I have and what I don't have. So I'm probably going to write down, if somebody bought this dress or this coat or this suit, I'm going to write down, we have to order another one. This person, I have an account with them. They borrowed this amount of money. They're going to pay me on Sunday morning. Whatever it might be, sometimes when we have transactions, we have to write things down, and therefore the Gemara says we're concerned. How can we do business on Shabbos? Maybe we're going to come to write something. So, that's why we're not allowed to do business on Shabbos. It's a rabbinic prohibition. What happens in the following scenario? What if the business deal is done without me actively doing anything? For example, we have nowadays Amazon bidding, or eBay bidding. So I put in a bid, and the bid is over on Shabbos, and I already gave my credit card. The bid is over on Shabbos, I'm going to win the item on Shabbos. So now I'm doing a business transaction, I'm buying or I'm the seller, either way. I'm buying or I'm selling, and I've done absolutely nothing. It happened by itself on Shabbos. What would you say? Is that considered a prohibition of doing business on Shabbos? Well, I didn't really do anything. Everything was set up before Shabbos started. So it's a rabbinic prohibition. So do we say that because it's a rabbinic prohibition, therefore you can violate it even passively? Perhaps. And that's why there are many that discuss this. Let's say we all have the big nightmare of Erev Pesach that falls out on Shabbos. And it's a nightmare for women more than it is for men. But what do we serve that Shabbos? Do we serve chametz? Do we serve matzah? What are we supposed to be serving? So that's a big question. So we have a very simple way to get around the problem. Listen to this. Why don't we set up the sale with the non-Jew on Erev Shabbos and say that it should all go into effect on Shabbos afternoon? So what do? We keep chametz in our homes, and let's have regular chametz meals Friday night and Shabbos morning, and anything that's left over will automatically be sold to the non-Jew on Shabbos. And I set up the whole system before Shabbos. I signed the contract, I did the documentation, everything's done, I sold it to him, I gave him my key, everything's ready to go. It's just going to go into effect automatically on Shabbos. Am I allowed to do that? Why not? What have I done? Well, I'm doing a transaction on Shabbos, but I'm not actively involved. I didn't do anything. Everything was set up before Shabbos started. This is a very relevant question, as we said, for nowadays that many of us live our lives online, and we order things online, and we have things that come automatically to us online. It's something that we need to think about, and it's something that we really need to consider. When are we in violation of this prohibition of mekach u'memkar on Shabbos, of doing transactions, business transactions on Shabbos? At what point do we say that that transaction goes through and I am now in violation of the Isser? So we had a person in this community, I don't remember who it was, if it's anyone here, I'm not giving away any major details, but I think there was someone in the community who called on right after Pesach. And what was the shiloh that they had? It was an amazing shiloh. They have some sort of playgroup in their house or something of that nature, and they have an automatic shipment from Amazon that comes on a certain day of the month. So they have 10 boxes of Cheerios and probably 10 boxes of granola bars and a bunch of things that are needed for the playgroup that they have in the house, legal playgroup. And the person before Pesach went ahead and made sure that the order was not going to come until after Pesach was over. even though the normal date when it's supposed to come is during Pesach, but they made sure to delay it. As it turns out, it was delivered on Shvi Shel Pesach. So this woman didn't want it to be eaten by the animals outside and didn't want that it should get wet by the rain, so she kicks it into her house, puts it in the garage, and now calls us after Pesach to ask whether or not this is something that should be permissible or not. Do you assume that that's considered to be chametz she'avar alav ha-Pesach? You have chametz that was in the possession of a Jew on Pesach. You actually acquired it on Pesach. Your credit card was charged on Pesach. Should we assume that that's permissible, or perhaps now it has all become forbidden? That's a major question, and it was a considerable loss because there was a big shipment for the whole month that she was going to use, and that was a major question that we had to deal with. So Rabbi Axelrod called Rabbi David Cohen right after Pesach, and he asked him the question. Rabbi David Cohen said, "It's too complicated. I don't know what to tell you." Now, he's a very reputable person. I go to the OU on Fridays, and I together with a number of my friends, other Rabbanim, go to the OU on Fridays, and we discuss with my father all the questions that came up during the week. So we discussed this with him that Friday after Pesach, and it took, I think, about 5 or 6 hours. We were dealing solely with this question to figure out what the parameters are and whether it should be permissible or not. It's a very complicated issue, but it stems very much from this fact of nowadays, when we have all of this buying and selling online, and you don't really see the product, you don't really know what it is before it comes. Again, you know it's a box of Cheerios, but you don't always know exactly which box of Cheerios it's going to be. You have to really figure out when are you considered to be the buyer, and when are you still considered to be just somebody who's inquiring, somebody who's looking into it. At what point do we say the transaction goes through? Is it when they charge my credit card? Is it when it's shipped to my house? Is it when it's brought into my house? All of these are extremely relevant and important questions, and we need to figure out, as society continues to become more and more complicated, we need to figure out how we're going to deal with that in terms of Shabbos. One final point that I'd like to make for that, don't do it next year. But in the end of the day, when that happened, we were makel, and we said for a number, a confluence of factors, it was permissible. But it was complicated to get to that answer, not simple at all. Let me just make one final point about this, which I think is an extremely relevant point. The Gemara says that we have a prohibition not only for human beings to do malacha on Shabbos, but there's a prohibition for our animals to do malacha as well. The Pasuk says, "Ato vincha vitecha, avdecha v'amasa v'hemtecha." Our animals are not allowed to do work for us on Shabbos either, even if we're not involved in that malacha. The animal itself is not allowed to do it. What about our appliances doing malacha for us on Shabbos? So the Gemara says, appliances, no problem at all. Your appliances are allowed to do malacha for you on Shabbos because there's no prohibition of shvisas kelim. There's no prohibition to stop my appliances from doing malacha on Shabbos. So the Gemara gives the case. Poskimayim legina. I turn on the sprinkler system, and I know that it's going to go the whole Shabbos and irrigate my field. So that's a malacha. I'm not allowed to do that, but that's my appliance doing the malacha. And I set it up before Shabbos, and everything's in motion. Even though I know that something's going to happen over Shabbos, that's not a problem at all. However, says the Gemara, there's one case where it's prohibited. And the case the Gemara gives is where you have an appliance called a rechayim, which is a mill. So you put all the wheat in the mill before Shabbos, and now as Shabbos goes, the wind is going to blow it, and it's going to turn around, or the water is going to fall on it, and it's going to spin around, and now it's going to crush my wheat over the course of Shabbos. Says the Gemara, that is prohibited. Why is that prohibited? I set up the system before Shabbos. I'm staying far away. Let's say it's on my farm somewhere. I'm nowhere near it. So why should we be concerned? What is the prohibition of having my mill run on Shabbos if that's a regular appliance in my house or in my farm? Shouldn't that be the same as the sprinkler system? Shouldn't that be the same as everything else? Why should that be permissible on Shabbos? I'm sorry, why should that be prohibited on Shabbos? And the answer the Gemara gives is because Hashma'as Kol is something we need to be concerned about. Yes, it's true that our appliances are allowed to do malacha for us on Shabbos. However, not when it's going to cause a noise as that malacha is being done. Which leads us to the issue of a dishwasher or a vacuum cleaner. So you have somebody, even if you don't have one of those, that goes by itself. But let's say you have a housekeeper in the house who's going to vacuum on Shabbos. That is something that is not really permissible because we assume, even though it's just my appliances doing the malacha, but since that malacha is being done and it's hashma'as kol, there's a great noise that's coming about as a result of that. So we have to be concerned of doing something of that nature on Shabbos because somebody who passes by my house doesn't know that I'm not doing the malacha. And the same goes with the dishwasher. So we cannot set a dishwasher to go on a timer in order that it should run and activate on Shabbos because that's something that creates noise. That's Hashma'as Kol. And therefore we assume that is not permissible. Nowadays the question is raised, what about when I have a situation where we have the silent dishwashers? Which a friend of mine recently told me he has one of them. And I asked him, how silent is it? He says, it's so silent that I've flooded my kitchen a number of times because I've opened it up in the middle while it's going. Well, if that's the nature of the dishwasher that you have, that's a very different kind of question. Maybe that would be permissible because it's actually silent. And that falls under the general category of our appliances are allowed to do malacha for us on Shabbos. There's no problem with doing that as long as the system is set up in place before Shabbos begins. So the Beis Yosef talks about, what about an alarm clock? How am I ever allowed to set an alarm clock on Shabbos? Don't I know that the alarm clock is going to make noise? Isn't that the same as the vacuum cleaner? So how can I ever set an alarm clock? Shouldn't that be a problem of my appliance doing a malacha and violating something which is creating a noise in my house? Maybe someone who walks by is going to think I'm doing a malacha. So the answer, says the Beis Yosef, is an alarm clock, that's the nature of the alarm clock. Everybody knows you set an alarm clock, it means you set it the night before. You didn't set it on Shabbos itself to go off now. So therefore he says, since that's the nature of what it is, therefore we assume that that's absolutely permissible. Everybody knows that's the way it works. And I think that's the answer as well for an air conditioner. How can we have an air conditioner running on Shabbos? Because everybody knows. You don't turn it on right now when you need it. You set it up before Shabbos goes, and everybody knows that's the way, today at least, that's the way the air conditioners go. Rav Moshe Feinstein talked about, what about the lights going on and off? So in the early days, the lights going on and off was an indication that you probably were not a Shabbos observant Jew. Nowadays, it has become so prevalent that everybody uses Shabbos clocks and the lights go on and off. Everybody knows when they look into your home and they see the lights going on and off, everybody knows that it means you have set it on a timer before Shabbos, and therefore there certainly would not be a prohibition to use the Shabbos clock on Shabbos. But for other appliances which do make noise and which people are not aware that the system was set up in place before Shabbos, that would pose a major halachic challenge, and we would have to figure out which ones might be permissible because everybody understands, and which ones perhaps we have to shy away from because on Shabbos that would pose a issue of Hashmaz Kol. So Mirtz Hashem, next week we will continue.